We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
It's time for the ClimateCast. It's our weekly conversation about the science of climate change. Today, how lakes worldwide are being affected by climate change. Our guest is going to join us in a moment, but NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner is here. Welcome. I feel like I haven't seen you in decades.
I know, you world traveler. You welcome home.
Good to have you here. Paul, this is something that we are quite interested in here in the land of lakes. And what I want to talk a little bit about the context of the science. NASA and the National Science Foundation coming together to do this research and using some different technology to do it.
Yeah, and this study has a couple of surprises in it, really, too, Carrie. But they looked at 235 lakes worldwide. And what they did was they used both satellite data and field data, surface observations over the past 25-plus years. And what they found is that the lakes are warming much faster than the oceans, for example, which are warming at a tenth of a degree Celsius per decade, even than the surrounding air. And that Lake Superior, for example, is one of the fastest warming lakes on Earth. It's warming at the rate of 2 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. That doesn't sound like a lot, but project that out 50 years, you've got a Lake Superior that's 10 degrees warmer. That could be a very different lake in terms of ice cover and the ecosystems within the lake. So the question is, why is a big, deep, cold lake like Lake Superior more sensitive to climate change than many other lakes around the world? And that's something I know Jay Austin will help us answer
today. Yeah, let's bring him in. Jay Austin is a professor at the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and he's one of the authors of the new study. And he's with us from Duluth. And Jay, welcome. So glad you could be on the show.
Good morning, Carrie. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning,
Jay. Thanks for having me on.
Why don't we just pick up on that question that Paul asks, which is how do you get a lake that's got the depth and the breadth and the coldness of Lake Superior and see these kinds of changes? What's going on?
Well, I think the thing to do is to back up here and just realize what a contribution this paper has been in the sense of being able to get so many data records together in one place and having them so consistent. What we're doing at this stage is really descriptive. We're basically looking for features of lakes that appear to lead to greater rates of warming.
Mm-hmm.
And like you guys have been saying, Lake Superior is really high on that list, one of the top few in the list of 235 lakes. And it does appear that, in general, around the world, lakes in colder climates tend to be warming faster. Part of that, I think, is probably due to the fact that those colder lakes tend to be at mid to high latitudes. And in general, the climate warming signal, if you will, tends to be stronger at mid and high latitudes than it is in the tropics. But the other thing is, and this is work that I've been involved in for several years now, is the role that ice plays in determining these summer water temperature trends.
Will you talk about that, where ice fits into this?
So, and this is ground that I'm pretty sure we've covered even on this program. The idea that the amount of ice you have in the winter actually plays a relatively strong role in determining what goes on for the rest of the year. So when you have a year that has lots and lots of ice, a lot of sunlight that would normally enter the lake in the late winter and early spring just gets bounced back into space. It reflects off the surface of the ice and results in a cooler sort of start to the summer season. On the other hand, if you take that ice away, a lot more heat can get absorbed in those winter and spring months, and you end up with a warmer lake, not just in the winter and spring, but a warmer lake later in the year, even into the summer.
Yeah.
Jay, I'm very interested in that, and I'm interested in the fact that it seems like small temperature changes can cause big differences in ice cover. I think you've published or some people that as little as 2 degrees Celsius difference can be, you know, the difference between relatively little ice and a mostly ice-covered Lake Superior. Is Lake Superior that sensitive to temperature change when it comes to ice cover?
Yeah, this is work that a graduate student of mine, Dan Tietze, did a little bit towards the end of last year, looking at basically just the winter average air temperature and showing that it was very, very highly correlated with the amount of ice that forms over the course of the winter season. And it seems like sort of an obvious thing, you know, colder years result in more ice. But what was really surprising to us was exactly what you pointed out, is that the difference between a year where you don't see any open water ice on Lake Superior. And so you might have ice in fringing bays and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. you don't have any open water ice. 2012 is a good example of a year like that. And a year where we have lots of ice, and we have, you know, ice fishing out of Duluth, and people are recreating on the ice, and maybe it impacts the shipping season. So there are all these sort of societal impacts. The difference between those 2 years might result from a difference in average air temperature of as little as 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hmm.
And so I think that what that tells us is that, you know, we often talk about this climate problem. One of the things that's difficult about conveying the issues surrounding climate science to the public is that the differences we talk about sound really small, you know, a degree here over the next 10 or 20 years, a couple degrees. But it turns out that a lot of these systems are really, really sensitive to these very, very small changes. So, this curve is very, very steep, and we're sort of sliding into the region where we're going to see more and more of these very low ice years. Those low ice years are going to lead to these warmer summers.
Jay, I think Paul alluded to this, to the when you add that up over 30, 40, 50 years, it's mm-hmm. significant changes, and that raises the biological changes that happen in the lake. And here's something that I was thinking about as I read this study. We did an interview a few months ago with I think it was somebody out of Texas who had done research on how fish in certain places in the ocean have already been adapting to climate change, to warming temperatures. And I wonder if you've done any research or seen any that says, boy, these biological changes, there's no chance that the fish and the other life in the lake can adjust to that, or we don't know.
It's a great question, and it's a really, really difficult one. It turns out that in this case, the physics is pretty easy.
Okay.
And it's biology, and when you start to try to untangle how ecosystems are going to respond to these changes, things get really, really complicated. One thing I will point out is, first of all, when you're a fish in the ocean and things change over time, you have the ability to move, north or south to a region where you might be more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That opportunity doesn't exist for a fish in a closed system like a lake. So that sort of, you know, sort of migratory adjustment to these changes is not a viable path. On the other hand, one of the great threats facing the Great Lakes and lakes around the world right now is the threat of invasive species.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that Lake Superior has so far been relatively low on the totem pole as far as invasive species impacts is the fact that it is so cold. It'll be interesting to see what happens as the lake warms up.
You're listening to the Climate Cast. It's our weekly conversation about the science of climate change. And Jay Austin is with us. He's a professor at the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth and one of the authors of a new study on how climate change is affecting lakes around the world, including Lake Superior. Paul?
Jay, I'm curious about near shore, where most of us live, versus offshore in a big lake like Superior. Are there significant differences in the way lakes are reacting to climate change?
So to be clear, the data from Lake Superior for this paper comes from offshore buoys.
Mm-hmm.
So buoys that are maybe 40, 50 miles offshore, and so way out in the middle of the lake, and they're away from the impacts of nearby land, and the water is very deep. I am not aware, and this is something that's bugged me since I've been here, I'm not aware of any long-term records of nearshore water temperatures.
Hmm.
It's sort of an interesting question, and it would be a worthwhile thing to pursue to look at how, especially these very, very large lakes. If you look at that list of 235 lakes, many of them are very small. We basically included lakes where there was enough data to come up with a statistically significant trend. So we were judging more on the availability of data than we were judging on the size of the lake. But it would probably be worthwhile to start thinking about what can we infer about trends in the near shore, given what we know about what's going on offshore in these large lakes.
Jay, I thank you so much for the time this morning. Really good to have your insight on that study.
Great. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on.
Jay Austin with us from the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. Paul, I don't want to miss a chance to ask you about some of the other climate news that you've been keeping an eye on.
Well, how about this? A rare tropical storm in January in the Atlantic. Alex was named yesterday by the National Hurricane Center.
I hadn't heard about this.
First January tropical storm since 1978. That's only happened three other times, Carrie. We've also got one in the Pacific, Polly. It is the earliest hurricane to form in the Central Pacific on record. So the definition of what we call hurricane season, continually being stretched, it seems, as we go forward. And there's a solar jobs boom. We've talked about this before, right? 2015, solar jobs grew 20% in the United States. There's now a total of 208,000 solar jobs in the United States, expected to add another 30,000 jobs next year. And of course, we've been waiting for the official numbers on 2015. The early data from Berkeley Earth shows that it was unambiguously the hottest year ever. This is interesting because this data comes from Richard Mueller with Berkeley. It was set up initially as sort of a check on the NASA and NOAA numbers. There was some Koch money that went into that. And yet the data that they found absolutely is in line with the rest of the world data sets. So you'll look for more of that in the next week as the official agencies, NASA, NOAA, the UK Met Service, and the Japan Meteorological Agency come out with their final numbers for 2015.
You're not going to leave without talking about the Godzilla El Nino, are you?
No.
Don't disappoint me here, Paul.
I won't. The Uber Godzilla El Nino has peaked officially.
It's peaked?
Yeah,
really?
It's peaked, but the effects will last through spring. It looks like, and it officially has tied 1997-98 as the strongest El Nino on record. Update just came out on that today as well, so something we'll be watching into next. We could be in La Nina next winter. We could be talking about a cold winter in Minnesota.
Not when we are facing
Slam,
a weekend
bang.
Of super. Don't tell me that. Oh, Paul, you may leave now.
Thank you.